Today on The Grave Talks, Dark Side of the Dead, a conversation with Connie LeFave. At the age of 5, Connie LeFave had her first encounter with the paranormal. The experience would only be the beginning of a life that would lead her into helping those affected by the paranormal. From possessions to ghostly animals, Connie's had experiences that some would find hard to believe. However, these events are all too real. Today we hear her story on The Grave Talks.
You know, it's amazing that you say that because it is really true about most of us in the paranormal. We all have a starting place. We all have a starting point. And for me, it was at childhood. And I really didn't like pay attention to it that much until I was later. Mm-hmm. But I was 5 years old when it first happened to me. Mm-hmm. And people don't go looking for these things to happen. It just kind of happens to you.
Sure.
And that's what like gets you going. But I was living with my grandmother, my great grandmother. This was before I was adopted, and I was living in a very poor house. And so as I was growing up, I was sleeping with my sister and my grandmother in a really, really big bed in a room. Mm-hmm. So we all kind of just slept together and kind of huddled together on the bed. And the bed was up against the wall, and I would always sleep closest to the wall. And I have this thing where I used to lay on my stomach and stick my hand in between the wall and the bed. Mm-hmm. So like, that's the way I always slept. And I was doing that night. I was sleeping on my stomach and I woke up and I turned and I maneuvered my hand down in between the wall and the bed, like I always do. And I'm wide awake. And so it couldn't have been me daydreaming or just, you know, dreaming it up, but something grabbed me and it was my hand that it grabbed my arm, my wrist area. Mm-hmm. And it was cold. And I was like, oh, this must be a joke. You know, I was only 5 though. But as a 5-year-old, you know, you scream, you don't think this is a joke. Mm-hmm. You think that later. At the time I was just like, what? And it started tugging on my hand and I could feel the fingernails. I mean, I could feel the details of this encounter, which is why it's so weird. Because normally you don't feel something like that. It was like a hand grabbing me and it was cold.
Yeah.
And so it grabbed me and then it clutched on. And then I felt my head banging up against the wall as it was trying to pull me through. I was like screaming at the top of my lungs as something's trying to drag me through the wall. Mm-hmm. And it couldn't have been anybody under the bed because the bed was one of those box beds, you know, where it's filled up and there's nothing underneath.
Yeah.
This was back in, you know, 78, 76. Mm-hmm. And in Abilene, Texas is where I was at. And I was getting pulled through the stupid wall and I'm screaming bloody murder. And I finally break free from the grip. And it was such a hard break that I flipped over on top of my sister and my grandmother. It lasted for maybe a good 10 seconds. And, you know, they were waking up as I was screaming. Mm-hmm. But this thing had a hold of me the whole time as I'm trying to break free. And I was only 5. So like, you can imagine the trauma afterwards the rest of the night. I think I peed the bed that night.
Sure.
I'm pretty sure that I did not want to sleep on that side of the bed ever again.
Yeah.
Even to this day, I don't like sleeping on that side of the bed. I just have a thing about it. And so that's what got me in, you know, to thinking about the paranormal and realizing there was something there when maybe I didn't realize it or pay attention to it before. Mm-hmm. And nothing like that major happened to me again for a really, really long time. But I always had it in the back of my head that I wanted to find out what it was about.
Sure. I mean, what a traumatic thing. It wasn't just a quick, you know, oh, I feels like maybe something grabbed me. You had an experience where it's tugging at you. It's pulling you into the wall. I mean, it's the reason I don't have my arms hanging off the bed at night. It's because
I'm starting to think that maybe I shouldn't have been doing that in the first place now.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those childhood things where, you know, some people are fine with it and some are not. Some are just, I'm going to err on the side of fear and not do that. That's what I would always do. But you actually,
that in the closet monster,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but you actually had it happen. So after you break free and your family members are waking up, how are they responding to you at that point in time? Obviously trying to calm you down, but how are they responding to what you're saying just occurred?
Well, obviously they're going to tell you what everybody gets told when they're a kid. And they think a monster's under the bed. Mm-hmm. go back to sleep. It was just a nightmare. You know, you didn't see or feel anything. It didn't really happen to you. But I literally made them get up and check under the bed for me before I'd even leave and lay back down. And then I wouldn't lay back on that side of the bed, yeah. But they tend to calm you, but at the same time reassure you that nothing really happened, mm-hmm. when you know something clearly did.
Sure.
So I think that's a big, downfall in the paranormal community is we tend to tell people, oh, that didn't really happen to you. You didn't really have that experience. You must be out of your mind, without even investigating it or looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but here we are as a parent family, and we're seeing the, you know, the other side.
So they were doing, you know, the typical, you know, parental and the thing of just let's calm down. This didn't happen. You're imagining it. It was a dream, this or that. Did, as time progressed, is that the stance that they stuck with, or was there any other things that occurred in that house? Because that seems like quite a dramatic thing to have happen, mm-hmm. with nothing else happening either. Were there other things?
Well, I was there for a very short time because I was put in foster care shortly after.
Okay.
So I didn't get to stay in that house, but I can tell you that the house did not feel easy, mm-hmm. when I did live there. And, you know, I didn't have any more paranormal experiences like that,
mm-hmm.
but I did feel kind of an uneasy heaviness in the house, mm-hmm. where I wasn't as comfortable before as I was then. I think a lot of things attach to you when you're at a weakened state, when you're stressed out, when you're weak in your mind. And I think that's what had happened. I think we were at a state where we were at a weakened state, and things tend to latch onto you when you're like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it never happened again at that location. And when I was adopted and put into foster care with my sister, you know, I never went back to that house.
Sure. Did your sister ever discuss that with you again, as far as that night and what occurred later?
Yes, yes, we have discussed it, and she believes me because she's had things happen to her over her lifetime. Hers were later.
Okay.
And I don't know, maybe something followed us around for a while and latched onto her. But, you know, we never talked about it that much afterwards, but it has come up in conversation. Like, I remember that time when this happened, and she was like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, is things like that went, you know, that pop up.
So how did life continue to progress for you? I know you said you got into foster care and then had an adoptive family. I mean, tell me what was life like then? Did you have other occurrences that happened within childhood?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I was struggling so much, even in my adopted family, just trying to fit in and do what I was supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
that I think those types of things I kind of ignored, okay. mostly in my life. Like I might've seen something out of the corner of my eye or heard something, but I just wrote it off to being illogical. I never really put the pieces together until later, you know, when I became an adult and I started seeking these things out. Literally because I wanted to find answers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it never really latched onto me like that afterwards. So, but I have had experiences all throughout my life where I've encountered these things, and I just, sometimes I don't know how to react. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I'm so drawn into it that I just have to find out more.
Sure.
And I think my childhood up to now, I had this like religious journey,
mm-hmm.
And it's just morphed over time. But in the end, I just ended up being, you know, a Protestant non-denominational Christian, but I still want the answers.
Sure.
And so that's what's led me to seek out the paranormal and learn about it. And then in the meantime, we're still having, you know, my husband and I, when we got married, we were already ghost hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And then we joined a team called After Dark, and we were there for a while. And we had experiences there. And then we joined a TAPS family team in San Antonio, stayed on that team for a while, moved to South Texas, and then started the Graveyard Shift Paranormal Investigations. When we were down in South Texas, we did a lot of exploration for probably, you know, 10 years. We were down there 5 years, but we eventually moved, came to San Angelo, where I'm from, and continued our investigations here.
Tell me about how, obviously, you had that very, you know, traumatic experience at the age of five, And then you go through, you know, childhood and trying to find your way there and navigate all that is childhood under some difficult circumstances. As you got older, was there another moment then at some point, whether it be teen years, 20 years or something like that, where you said, you know, I do want to take a more serious look at this, because obviously that was part of your mind and it was part of your mindset mm-hmm. of being curious. But, you know, to take the leap from just I'm curious about this to I want to dive into that really for the first time, you know, as an adult with far more power than a 5-year-old has.
Right.
Was there a moment where you decided to do that? Was there an event that occurred that kind of triggered that? Or was it just kind of a decision?
And I'm going to be honest with you. I was a late bloomer. My experiences started much later in life.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird that I would have that big of a gap from childhood to now. I'm 50 now.
Mm-hmm.
And my journey began probably when I was about 36 or so. So like I had that traumatic experience and I was growing up knowing it was there.
Yeah.
And seeing my sister have things happen to her. I remember one day we were teenagers and she sat up in the middle of the bed and she was in a total comatose. She sat up and put her hands up. I thought she was maybe sleepwalking. Mm-hmm. And then I saw sparks flying from her fingers. I didn't know what was going on. And so like I've seen things like that in my teen years, and then they just go away
mm-hmm.
With no real explanation and me not really wanting to explore it because of the place I was in.
Sure.
And it was only until I was in my 30s when I felt courageous enough to say, I want to find out what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't until I started hunting with Dan and of course, ghost hunters on TV. Sure. I was like, oh, I want to do that too. I didn't know there was groups you could get into
mm-hmm.
to do these things. Then it really started happening for me. So many experiences, so many ghost stories from all over, just everywhere, up until being the owner of the Old Park Hotel.
So in your 30s, when you were about 36, you decided, I really want to dive into this. I'm in a place where I think I can do this. How did that begin? I mean, how did that journey start as far as investigating? I mean, how did you go from just being, I'm really curious, I've had these experiences, to let's dive in deeper?
Well, and I'm going to tell you, everybody has their experiences that make them take their journeys.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was that one. And then there was this whole moving into religion thing.
Okay.
Because of my relationship, you know, with Christ or God, I wanted to explore what was there for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I can't ignore that there's not something there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how long can you go in your life and not realize that there's something right there all the time and you just haven't taken the time to understand it? So I had a deep desire to understand. I got an interest in demonology. And so I started looking into those things because I wanted to find out what the relationship was and why it was here and what makes it tick.
Yeah.
When I joined the Army when I was 18, I had a deep desire to learn to analyze things. And so I think that thing that when I did when I was 18, joining the military, it taught me how to be an intelligence analyst. And ever since then, I've been an analyst. I like to tear things apart. And I have this deep desire to want to find out what is on the other side because of it. So it's like a tree that grows, a seed that grows and just goes out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that happens early in life. And sometimes that happens later in life. For me, it was a little bit later in life.
Yeah. So did you just immediately, did you find a group to join initially? Did you just start kind of looking around for things on your own? How did that begin?
Goodness gracious. It's sad to say, but I was going through my third divorce.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an awful time in my life. I thought I had all my ducks in a row. And of course, I went back to that stressed life again.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to get away from the reality of what I was living.
Sure.
And do something that made me happy that I wanted to do for myself. For me, that was exploring the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching TV. And when I first saw Ghost Hunters, I was like, well, I didn't know that you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking in San Antonio, where I was living at the time, for groups to join. And so I got a hold of a guy named Eddie Hill, who was the founder of After Dark Paranormal. And his best friend was Dan LaFave. So they were on the team and that's where I started. And I'm the analyst. So I was made researcher right away.
Mm-hmm.
And And from there, we just kept having experiences together at that point.
Yeah.
But the religion aspect of it made me want to study demonology. It made me want to explore, you know, the relationship between reality and maybe what's out there. And so, like, I never really can satisfy that thirst. And I keep creating theories and then trying to prove them or disprove them.
Sure.
So, yeah.
So what were some of those first experiences that you had, you know, essentially on your second or your go round into this? You're entering this as wanting to seek these things out. It's not just happening at random points in time. You are seeking out, investigating these sort of things and analyzing these sort of things. What were some of those first experiences that you had in that sort of capacity?
Well, I would have to say it began probably at the Black Swan Inn, because that was probably one of my first places I ever investigated. And being a brand new investigator in a place that is known to be haunted, I didn't expect much. I didn't really. But then we started looking at the evidence and things started happening to us that made me open my eyes. The first being we walked into the downstairs dining room and we're taking pictures and flipping them back. And then we see a woman glowing back at us in a reflection. There's no woman in the room. I'm looking at this picture and it's a woman with jowls and her eyes are like white in the picture. And that was the first time I'd ever actually seen a picture of an actual ghost. We debunked it. There was nobody else in the room. We just tore it apart. And then on the same investigation, we're seeing a little boy in a picture down at the bottom of the stairs. How do you explain these things when they happen? Mm-hmm. I remember going around in a corner and going into the bathroom and standing in there for a while. And all of a sudden I start seeing light anomalies pop up in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So like at that moment, I realized there's more to this than I'm really seeing. I need to dive deeper and really analyze and take a look at what's going on. So like you begin your series of debunking to find out what's really there and what's really not. And then I remember we went on I think it was a Wildflower Cemetery, and my God, that place is scary. I remember walking with my group into the cemetery, and it would have been my first cemetery. And of course you want to respect everything. It was a public place and we weren't really in the grave area. We were more towards the forest line. Mm-hmm. My husband and I and Eddie, we walked into the cemetery, start investigating. And I turned my back and someone screams and we all look up and at least three of the guys and me, we see a wolf step out of the forest and just stand there and stare at us with of course the wide eyes at night.
Yeah.
But the second I look up, this wolf vanishes. And there was at least three or four of us that saw it. So like, it was my first time ever seeing an animal, a ghostly animal like that. Mm-hmm. So like, it's weird when you look at that, because it makes you realize, there's regular ghosts and then there's other kinds of ghosts. And then there's the inhuman ghost or the inhuman entity.
Yeah.
So like over all this time, I've had dozens and dozens of experiences that have brought me to where I am now, even a demonic possession once, not for me, but going into Del Rio, we called that case the Del Rio Devil. We were contacted by a lady who was having trouble with her fiance. And she said that an entity had followed her around all of her life. And recently her fiance was acting strange. And all of a sudden he started screaming out, you know, in the middle of the night with these weird voices. And she wanted to know what we could do to help. Well, we're 7 hours away in San Antonio and she wants us to come to Del Rio right now. Couldn't do that. Had to wait 3 days. So we ended up packing the car and driving all the way there. And we told the rest of our team, it was graveyard shift at the time, hey, we're not asking you to come with us on this one, because this may be a demonic possession and we don't want you involved. Mm-hmm. And I guess when you enter these things, you really have to be grounded and you have to know what you're doing and you can't pretend. And when you go into the things, we were just trying to protect our friends and our loved ones. When we got there, we set up and we introduced ourselves and got everything hooked up. And we said, okay, we don't know what to expect. We interviewed them. We asked them what their religion was, because, you know, when you approach these things, you always want to ask and respect other people's religions or their belief systems, because you're not there to preach to them.
Sure.
You're there to help them find validation so they can get help or or go past that and direct them into the right places where they can get help. So we went in there and I said, I got an idea. Because people that have possession, they tend to black out and they don't remember a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It's one of the symptoms. So what we did was we created a sign for him. We said, and I don't even remember his name. I think it was Chris or Charlie. I don't even remember his name. We asked him and said, okay, what we're going to do is give you a sign and you have to tell us the sign so we know it's you. That way we can distinguish between you and a demonic entity if there is one. So what we did was we set up a sign and then we started our prayers, you know, the St. Michael's prayer, and we had our holy water and our Bible and all that stuff there. But basically what we did was we coaxed it out and we got 2 hours of videotape with this guy screaming and just totally wigging out. His eyes were dilated. He was speaking in voices we did not recognize. They tend to have attitudes and they're very strong, but it's not the screaming, vomiting pee stuff you see on TV. It's quite different. Their voices do change. Their physical appearance does slightly change. Their eyes do dilate. Their body does become contorted at some points. They're stronger than normal. And then they can't remember most of it. So like we managed to get the demon to come forward. And as soon as we had it on tape, we knew it was time to stop, because our job isn't to exorcise demons. It's to get validation and help for these people so somebody else can do it. Because sometimes exorcisms take, you know, forever, sure, 2-3 months, sometimes years. So that's the reason why paranormal investigators don't do that stuff.
Yeah.
It's not that we can't or don't want to. It's just that we don't have the time. We don't have the resources. And then that's not what we're there to do. Mm-hmm. So we just had multiple experiences like that all throughout our careers as ghost hunters.
So when you're mm-hmm. there and you get this call from someone saying, I think my fiance may be possessed. There may be something going on here. You're going in there, you know, knowing that this could be dangerous. You're telling your team members, look, I don't want all you coming. This is going to be a very small group. What do you have going through your mind as you're in that car ride driving down there that makes you feel safe, qualified, or you know, able to assist in something like that? I mean, because that's a pretty serious thing.
Right. It's scary just sitting there thinking about it.
Yeah.
The first thing you think of is, even though I'm a Christian and I feel really grounded, like you still have that little thing in the back of your head. This is, what are you doing? Are you crazy? Mm-hmm. And getting in the car, I'm thinking the whole time, okay, do I feel grounded right now? Am I prepared to go in like this? I have my partner with me. Is he grounded? That's what I was more afraid of, was, is my partner grounded? Is Dan grounded? Mm-hmm. Is he going to be able to handle this? Where does he really stand with God and all those things? And so we're driving 7 hours. We're freaking out because we're hearing all the screaming on the phone and the tape that we recorded, and it was a unnerving experience to hear that so far away. What we heard, it was not a human voice. It was not normal. And anybody that's listening to that could tell, you know, even a non-experienced person that is not in the paranormal. So we're driving down, and I'm making sure, okay, do I have my Bible? Do we know the St. Michael's prayer pretty well enough, you know, to bring it out, and is our equipment ready? And also emotionally, are we ready to deal with something we've never dealt with before?
Yeah.
Because eventually in this community, you have to learn how to help people in other ways besides just ghost hunting and collecting information. You've got to figure out, how do I help this person and how do I guide them so that they can have some peace? So we're freaking out all the way there. I mean, all the way there. That's all we could talk about. And we couldn't wait to get there fast enough because we knew this lady needed help. She was desperate. It was so horrifying to hear that voice and not being able to do anything about it.
What is your goal as you're heading there? I mean, what is the expectation of you from your client, and mm-hmm. and what is your goal going there to try and assist in this as you're driving down there? What's going through your mind at the end of the day? What do you want to do to help that person?
Sure. Well, after you diagnose this case, we were working with a priest. I can't even remember his name, Father Gonzalez. He was the one that was the apprentice to the assistant of the original case for, what was that Anthony Hopkins movie that was out? I can't remember the name of it.
Are you talking about The Exorcist?
No, not The Exorcist. I can't remember the name of it. Anthony Hopkins was trying to show the other priest, about what demonic possession really was. The rite. It was the rite.
The rite. Okay. Yep. The rite. Okay. Yep.
So the actual priest that did the rite, mm-hmm. he had an assistant.
Okay.
And that assistant had an apprentice, and that's the father we were talking to on the phone.
Okay.
And he got in on the case because this family was Catholic, and we wanted to, respect and honor their wishes. Mm-hmm. So we got involved with the priest to help them get evidence, because they wanted to do an exorcist, but they had, of course, the Catholic Church has to have evidence before they can do a full rite exorcist.
Sure.
Exorcism. So our job when we got there was to get the evidence, and we know how to get the evidence and bring it out. If there is a demonic possession there, we know how to do it. So our goal was to get it verified and on tape and recorded so that we could forward it to the right people so that they could deal with it.
So you're there to, you are not going there with the intent of you're going to get this demon out. You're going there of I'm going to get what they need then for the church then to take over and do their part, because without it,
that's exactly right.
They're kind of dead in the water. Is that did your client understand that going in?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We talked with the client way ahead of time, went through the whole process. We were very methodical when we did do our investigations. Mm-hmm. We'd always do a pre-interview. We would decide whether or not it warranted even an investigation.
Sure.
And then after we gathered the information, we could set up a time to go talk with them and look around. And then we would do a preliminary report. Okay, what's the activity here? How often does it occur? What's happening? Document it all. Mm-hmm. Find out if there was anything before that in the house, if you can, or on the land. Mm-hmm. Find out if they have any personal connections. And also, one thing we always ask if they were, we were trying to figure out if they were cuckoo or not.
Yeah.
Because in this field, you do have some nuts in it.
Oh, sure.
And you as an investigator have to figure out, okay, is this guy a nut or is he not a nut?
Well, I mean, obviously, getting a psychiatric evaluation and, mm-hmm. and having someone come in and see if there is any sort of mental illness going on. I mean, that's obviously number one.
And that's the hardest thing to do, too.
Sure. I mean, because again, you're going to have to either, unless you're sitting there with the psychiatrist or psychologist that's looking at them, you're still going to be taking them at their word that they either had this evaluation done or not.
That's right.
So
that's exactly right.
I mean, so sometimes I could imagine someone could say, yes, I've been evaluated, when in fact, no, they haven't, or not done by a qualified individual. I mean, so how do you, and I want to go back to this possession story, but I want to ask about mm-hmm. that since we're on it. I mean, how do you truly, what works for you and, mm-hmm. and your team to get a sufficient answer to that question of whether someone is suffering from some sort of mental illness versus there's something paranormal going on here?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Since Dan was in the Air Force and I was in the Army, I was an analyst. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're not mental health professionals.
Sure.
We don't have the right to go in and evaluate someone and tell them whether they're psychologically
no.
crazy or not. But what we do is we ask a series of questions that will help us get to the root of why they're having the issues. Like, for instance, what is your background? Where do you come from? Have you had any traumatic experiences in your life? One guy was a Vietnam vet. So that was in the back of our head when we were asking him questions. Mm-hmm. We thought he may have PTSD.
Sure.
So that might be tied to it. So we can't diagnose, but what we do is ask a series of questions to help us eliminate and come up with possibilities of other possible reasons why they may be experiencing these things. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we mainly just document it. And then once we've collected our evidence, we go back and evaluate and say, well, he did have this and this. And we try to tie it together or not tie it together, depending on what's going on. Mm-hmm. So really, that has been a good rule of thumb to follow when we did have our team together. Mm-hmm. When we had our team together, that was a good rule of thumb to follow on any investigation, was to make sure that we asked all the right questions, did our homework, provided all the information. So, and then you can make an evaluation. Okay, which way do we need to go here?
Yeah.
Do we need to go in and ask, say some prayers and get it on tape? Or do we need to call a psychic in who knows what they're doing to help out with the situation? And so like then in the field, you know, there's skeptics and then there's going to be people that are legit. So you also have to be able to separate that from what you do.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Connie. In part two, what does one do when they're dealing with a possession and have to wait for the church to come and help? What can be done to help someone deal with the potential dangers of a possession? How did Connie and her husband Dan become owners of the haunted Old Park Hotel in Ballinger, Texas? And what kind of spirits haunt the halls of the Old Park Hotel? Those questions and more in part two. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Sign up to be one at patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month gets you access to all of our episodes in their entirety, as well as advanced episodes of the show, and it's all commercial free. That's what helps keep this program on the air. Without it, we would not exist. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.